Today is Thursday, August 5th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Afghan women and children face perilous future amid Taliban gains.
Human rights workers share a concern that the hands-off approach by the international community imperils a generation of women and children that had been mostly shielded from the Taliban.
Plus, head of U.S. agency draws sharp contrast between Ethiopia and Sudan.
The country is now experiencing a fragile yet hopeful transition to a civilian-led democracy. In Ethiopia, a long-standing partner of the United States, the case is starkly different.
Also, WHO says more than 700 healthcare workers killed between 2018 and 2020. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The Afghan Defense Ministry says its air force has carried out more airstrikes against Taliban positions in southern Afghanistan, while the insurgent force makes additional gains in the country's north. In a statement, they say airstrikes were carried out across the country on Thursday, including in the southern Helmand province, where the provincial capital of Lashkargah is being fiercely contested. The Taliban control of 9 of the city's 10 police districts. Residents in Lashkargah reported heavy bombing near the government and radio and television station, which is under Taliban control and is near several wedding halls and a guest house of the provincial governor. The fighting has driven thousands of people from Kandahar and Helmand provinces in the south to seek refuge in Kandahar City, which is under siege by the Taliban. Government forces control only 3 of Kandahar's province's 17 districts. U.S. troops are nearing completion of a withdrawal from Afghanistan, where experts say women and children face a perilous future. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has more.
When fighting rages between Afghan security forces and the Taliban, many caught in a crossfire are forced to flee their homes. Most of them are women and children. 5 such families found refuge in this small house. Among them are 3 widows and many orphans with nowhere else to go and for whom school is no longer an option. Displaced widow Guldastav says she lost her husband and 3 sons to the fighting. She tells VOA her grandchildren now provide for the family as trash collectors in Kabul.
Look at these little kids. They are collecting paper and plastic from garbage. Is this work for little kids? What did Ashraf Ghani do for us? What did Karzai do? What did Taliban do for us? They widowed our girls. We've been here for months. No cooking, no meat, no good clothes or shoes. They're still trying to get medicine.
Earlier this month, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani gave Parliament a broad outline of a new plan to reach stability within 6 months. Many question whether the government has that long.
It's been so alarming to watch the gains that the Taliban has made just in the last few weeks since the U.S. began this withdrawal. And it's been really distressing to sort of see the silence of the international community. This sort of disengagement and this sort of feeling like, you know, too bad, shame, there's nothing we can do.
Human rights workers share a concern that the hands-off approach by the international community imperils a generation of women and children that had been mostly shielded from the Taliban.
The Taliban still have same attitude, same behavior, same philosophy for their own self, like that they have their own war. And it's really not possible, it is difficult for all people of Afghanistan, I'm sure, and particularly for women and the youth.
A displaced man identifying himself as M. Omar tells VOA his family just wants a normal life.
Taliban, you have mothers and sisters like us. The government, too. You have families and mothers and sisters. For God's sake, stop the fighting. For the sake of the Holy Book, stop the fighting. If there is no war, we can go home and work to provide for our families. We left everything behind.
These displaced Afghans say the Taliban set landmines around the homes they fled. They say their children lost limbs. They join the millions of Afghans displaced in and out of their home country. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, on a visit to Sudan and Ethiopia, has starkly contrasted the trajectory of the two countries, saying Sudan is on a fragile path to democracy, while Ethiopia is mired in conflict and facing famine. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
The humanitarian crisis is growing in Ethiopia, and thousands are fleeing to neighboring Sudan. The U.S. is pushing for humanitarian access to millions in desperate need of food and medical supplies due to the fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray and other regions that has been raging since last November. The head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, traveled to Ethiopia and recalled a visit to Sudan 20 years ago when she never imagined it would become an inspiration.
But thanks to a youth-driven and largely peaceful revolution, one led primarily by Sudan's women, the country is now experiencing a fragile yet hopeful transition to a civilian-led democracy. In Ethiopia, a long-standing partner of the United States, the case is starkly different. A country that has been home to some of the most impressive development gains and economic growth anywhere on the continent, and a regional anchor of stability and security, now finds itself mired in conflict. The government's brutal campaign against the people of Tigray has put the country's people at risk of a prolonged civil war, and the people of Tigray at grave risk of imminent famine.
United Nations humanitarian chief Martin Griffiths said blanket accusations against humanitarian relief agencies, such as the ones made by an Ethiopian official, are dangerous. Adote Akwai of Amnesty International told VOA he agrees.
The rhetoric attacking the principle of humanitarian assistance really shakes and threatens the whole network of laws and conventions and obligations that were created to really try to prevent the worst from being done to people. But it also creates a dangerous kind of atmosphere that allows attacks against humanitarian operations and humanitarian workers, which is equally dangerous.
Akwe told VOA that other countries need to realize how serious the situation in Ethiopia is.
I think the Biden administration has been fairly clear and unambiguous in its leadership and what it's tried to do and call for in Ethiopia. It's time for the rest of the UN Security Council and other African governments to step up and realize that this is a country that is now potentially going to fragment, and that's going to have major implications for Sudan, Djibouti, Somaliland, Eritrea.
The United Nations has also voiced its frustration at blockages and delays in getting humanitarian aid into Ethiopia's northern Tigray to deal with what it calls the catastrophic situation there. UNICEF says that more than 100,000 children in Tigray could suffer life-threatening malnutrition in the next 12 months. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, says the situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region is worsening by the day, with more than 5 million people needing help after Ethiopian and allied forces pursuing Tigray fighters were accused of looting and destroying food supplies. Tigray remains cut off from the outside world with communication links down and just one road available for aid convoys, which have faced numerous checkpoints and searches. While the West is said to be exploring the possibility of a humanitarian aid corridor from neighboring Sudan into western Tigray, the head of Ethiopia's National Disaster Risk Management Commission this week rejected that idea. During her visit, Power expressed concern about the, quote, dehumanizing rhetoric, unquote, used by Ethiopian leaders amid the nine-month-old conflict in the Tigray region. Analysts say Ms. Power's, quote, tough language, unquote, is unlikely to change the minds of those involved in the conflict. For more, I spoke with Ali Vergi, senior advisor to the African Center U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington.
From the point of view of attention from the United States, it's positive seeing that she went to Ethiopia. But from our practical outcomes, it's much harder to discern. The one positive thing that happened yesterday was that the World Food Program announced that the first convoy in some time had managed to reach Tigray. But at the same time, we also saw NGOs being thrown out of Tigray. So difficult to see that there was any substantial movement from her visits.
What do you make of her comment accusing Ethiopia of using some inflammatory languages and all that? Were people expecting her to confront the Ethiopian government head on?
I think we know that the power is not one to mince words, and I'm sure that when she spoke to officials privately, she was using tough language. It's certainly true that there's been inflammatory speech by all the parties to the conflict, and it's definitely important to recognize that this needs to be reined in and toned down. So I hope that her remarks were in the spirit of that as well.
Do you think her expression and, of course, her tough language is indicative that the United States might be looking for another way to firmly get a grip of what is happening and possibly a way out of the situation?
I think the U.S. is frustrated, deeply frustrated with the progress or the lack of progress in resolving this conflict. This is not the first high-level visit by a U.S. official. There have been senators, there have been envoys, there have been other diplomats who've been coming and going, and there have been a number of promises and commitments made by the Ethiopian government that haven't been lived up to. And so it's unsurprising to me that there is now frustration from the side of the U.S. administration.
Could she have done more?
I think the ability of anybody to change the minds of the parties in a very quick flying visit is very limited. But what's clearly needed is an understanding on all of the sides of the conflict, not only the Ethiopian government, but also the Tigrayan side, that there can't be a military solution to this. But it's easier to say that than to achieve it. And unfortunately, to this point, there hasn't been a clear plan laid out for how to resolve the dispute other than through military confrontation.
Is there a strategy to her visiting Sudan before going to Ethiopia?
Of course, there's lots of things going on in Sudan as well that need attention and a very tenuous transition there. And there's naturally this issue which does affect both Sudan and Ethiopia in terms of the border dispute. And so there are connections there. And ultimately, the region is increasingly concerned at the situation in Ethiopia. But the Ethiopians themselves are going to be the ones to have to resolve their domestic situation. They're the prime actors in any resolution.
There are reports of dead bodies washing off rivers around the area. What do you make of this? Is this an escalation of the conflict or something else is going on?
There's no reason to doubt those reports. Sudanese officials have very little reason to exaggerate. The likelihood of those bodies being washed up in those rivers suggests that there have been further atrocities committed. It's not likely that these were just normalized deaths. There's clearly been some terrible things that have happened to those people. I don't know if it represents an escalation of the conflict as such, because there have been numerous atrocities already. This is just latest in a long line of sad
That's Ali Vergi, senior advisor to the African Center U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington, speaking with me from London. The World Health Organization says more than 700 healthcare workers and patients were killed, more than 2,000 injured, and hundreds of health facilities destroyed in countries of conflict between 2018 and 2020. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A three-year analysis was carried out in 17 conflict-ridden countries and territories, including Ethiopia, Yemen, Syria, Mozambique, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Myanmar. New data show that healthcare continues to be under attack. So far this year, the World Health Organization has recorded 588 incidents in 14 countries with emergencies, causing 114 deaths and 278 injuries of healthcare workers and patients. The WHO's Director of Health Emergencies Interventions, Altaf Moussani, says the impact of those healthcare attacks goes well beyond claiming lives. He says the ramifications are significant and alarming, especially considering the ongoing COVID-19 response.
Their impact reverberates on healthcare workers' mental health and willingness to report to work, equally on communities' willingness to seek health care, and also drastically reduces resources for responding to a health crisis, amongst others.
Moussani says the ripple effect of a single incident is huge and has a long-lasting impact on the system at large. When health facilities are destroyed, he says, they need to be rebuilt. When healthcare workers are killed or wounded, he says a vital workforce must be reinforced. Building back those vital systems, he says, requires years of costly investment, years in which people in need are underserved.
During the pandemic, more than ever, healthcare workers must be protected, must be respected. Hospitals and healthcare facilities, including the transportation of ambulances, should not be used for military purposes. Essential conditions for the continued delivery of vital healthcare must be given the necessary space.
Moussami notes any reduction in capacity will interrupt services and deprive vulnerable communities of urgent care. The WHO is calling on all parties in conflicts to ensure safe working spaces for the delivery of healthcare services. It says people caught in emergency situations must be able to safely access care free from violence, threat, or fear. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Angry villagers in the Indian capital have held protests outside a crematorium where they say a 9-year-old girl was raped and killed earlier this week. The protesters, sitting on makeshift stage Thursday, held placards demanding justice for the girl who lived nearby. The case has revived outrage over the number of gruesome sexual crimes against women in India, as well as the treatment of those on the lowest rung of the country's rigid caste system from which the girl hailed. Police say 4 men suspected in the crime, all of them workers at the crematorium, have been arrested but have yet to be charged. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. South Africa's Cape Town is struggling to cope with more than 38,000 active cases of COVID-19, making it the epicenter of the pandemic in Africa's worst-hit country. Vicky Stock speaks to the provincial head of the nursing union in Cape Town, South Africa.
The provincial chairman of the Democratic Nursing Organization of South Africa, Eleanor Roberts, says medical staff is under immense pressure.
As of now, the situation in our rural areas, it is dire because of the fact that there is so much COVID patients coming in and there is so few staff to look after this patient.
She says there are about 13,000 nurses in the Western Cape, which is way too few.
Our members complain that they cannot take it. It is too much for them. There's not enough staff and there's also not enough beds, with the result that they have to struggle to put the COVID patients away from the other patients.
She believes the vaccination drive that is underway in the country is helping to some extent.
But I think the vaccinations in this case did help. However, in Western Cape, as we know, it is very slowly. Like as at last week, Thursday, we heard only 68% of our nurses were vaccinated. So we still are at a great risk.
The province's premier, Alan Windey, is due to give an update on the situation at a digital news briefing Thursday. Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
Greek firefighters on Wednesday grappled with fires raising swaths of forest lands on the outskirts of Athens. Thousands of residents have been evacuated from the region, and animals from tortoises to horses have been killed. For VOA from Athens, Anthi Kasarava reports experts are pressing for urgent measures, warning the blaze may be a precursor of new, more destructive fires in the coming days.
The inferno has scorched the slopes of Parnitha, just north of Athens, in a protected nature reserve. It started in a wooden ravine and is the most devastating of the approximately 80 wildfires that have broken out across the country in recent days, including on the island of Rhodes, as temperatures top 45 degrees Celsius, the hottest day here, in 4 decades. Authorities say the blaze is partially under control, but firefighters remain on alert for fear of flare-ups fanned by light winds that have sent thick plumes of noxious smoke over the capital. Health officials are advising locals and tourists to avoid local travel and to wear protective masks, already in use during the pandemic, to block the inhalation of toxic particles floating in the air. Water-dropping planes, 9 helicopters and dozens of water cannons have been used to battle the blaze. Soldiers, mountain rangers, and hundreds of volunteers have also joined in, helping evacuate locals and more than 100 horses from equestrian clubs scattered in the region. But the magnitude of the destruction has left this nation reeling. From early Wednesday, thousands of hectares of forest land were seen covered in grey ashes. The carcasses of burnt turtles, turkeys, deer, and horses lay scattered on the scorched land. Chicken coops were left charred, and herdsmen were seen early Wednesday counting their lost cattle in grazing lands across Barnitha. At least 80 homes have been razed. Greece's Homeland Security Chief Nikos Kardalias says Tuesday night was an exceptionally difficult night. He said the fire was under partial control on most sides, but there was still more work to be done. The intense heat has also placed a strain on Greece's power grid as people seek relief from the high temperatures. Antikarasava for VOA News, Athens.
Turkey is seeing one of its worst wildfires in decades, with at least 9 people killed as of Wednesday. As Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul, the Turkish government is coming under growing criticism because its fleet of firefighting planes is out of action.
Tourists and locals use buckets to fill a tank on a pickup truck with seawater to douse a nearby advancing fire. Lemes Seper, a volunteer, says it's a desperate struggle, especially in parts that cannot be reached by land. Seper said the air reinforcements are too weak. She says there are fires in too many places in Turkey at the moment, and she says crews cannot respond to them. When the more than 100 fires broke out last week over an area stretching more than 1,000 kilometres, Turkey only had 3 rented Russian firefighting aircraft. That is compared to neighbouring Greece, which has more than 20 aircraft to fight fires that are also raging on its territory. Local mayor Mohamed Tokat made an emotional appeal on social media for air support to fight the fires. Tokat said the state should fulfill its responsibilities and save the people from this suffering. He begs the authorities to send airplanes and helicopters to his area. Turkey's fleet of about 12 firefighting planes is unfit to fly. The aircraft belong to the Turkish Aeronautical Association, set up by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who founded the Turkish secular state nearly a century ago. Critics accuse Turkey's Islamist-rooted government of deliberately running down the association, a charge the leadership denies. Politics and law professor Ishtar Gözaydın has written several books on religious affairs in Turkey. She says there is hostility among the Islamist base of the ruling AKP party because the association was initially funded by hides of animals sacrificed during the Muslim festival of Eid.
It comes from a historical animosity. It was a mandatory act on the part of the secular state to confiscate their financial income of those skins of the sacrificed animals because skins have a financial value. Today, there is no requirement. Still, the hostility goes on between the religiously sensitive circles in Turkey and Turkish Aeronautical Association.
Pointing to a fleet of nearly 50 helicopters, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan insists there are adequate resources to fight the fires. In addition, Erdogan also said more firefighting airplanes from Russia had arrived and Iran, Ukraine and Azerbaijan were also sending aircraft. But offers of help from Israel and Greece have apparently not yet been accepted. Two Spanish planes have arrived as part of EU assistance. Spanish pilot Juan Ramon Martinez Borrego says it's going to be a tough fight.
The area is very big. We are talking about thousands and thousands of hectares. And also, one of the main problems that we have are the orography of the forest fire that we are attacking, and also the high altitude.
More firefighting airplanes from abroad are expected. But for some in Turkey, it's likely to be a bittersweet sight, given many of the aircraft arriving are identical to Turkish planes that remain out of action. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.